Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and my guest today is Chloe Arregis. Her novel, published by Catapult, is called Sea Monsters. I found it wonderful, fascinating, and it's a novel that's written according to certain impulses that are rather, I think, mysterious. The surface action of the book is that a young woman runs away from her home in Roma, in Mexico City, with a boy, Tomas, and she goes to Oaxaca, to a coastal town. What's the name of the town?
Zipolite.
Zipolite. And she's not very interested in the boy. She's interested in the movement of life, which becomes repetitive, resonant, and significant. The things she sees around her are things that she's also learned about in her father's study. She has learned about shipwrecks, and therefore she knows about sea monsters, the title of the book. Now, Chloe Arregis, you have a PhD in French poetry and magic, which has led you to the beautiful poems about the sea by Baudelaire. The book contains many shipwrecks within it, damaged aquariums, lost objects at the bottom of the sea, so that when you read this book, you're reading a surface that conduces to depths. Tell me about this.
That's a wonderful depiction of it. Well, yes, starting with the aquarium in her home, idea of framing certain wild visions and fantasies and aquariums as fragile ecosystems. So I suppose during adolescence, it's a time when one can act upon one's fantasies or try to reenact them or give them new forms in the real world. And so my character runs off to the beach and then realizes that the motives that drove her there are no longer interesting.
She's come to the beach at night. She discovers that the way to live is in hammocks that are strung by the ocean side. And she and this young man, he's mm-hmm. slightly older than she is, mm-hmm. but only slightly, mm-hmm. 2 years, mm-hmm. Are sleeping side by side in hammocks by the ocean, watching the sea foam, which is illuminated by night. And it seems to her that this is the poetry that the sea writes. This is the sea's message.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to give the book certain fragmentary form, and the way I structured it, I tried to mimic certain tidal rhythms, and that mirrored her own oscillation between, well, different kinds of longing and then being there and then thoughts of home and feelings of guilt that she tried to keep at bay and succeeded most of the time.
Well, you were born in Mexico City, am I right?
Well, I was born in New York, and then spent my childhood in Holland, and then moved back to Mexico when I was 7.
I see.
So Mexico City's home.
And your father was a diplomat? Is that how it was that you were living in so many places?
Yes, because Mexico used to like to send its writers abroad as diplomats. So.
And your father is a poet, and you've translated some of his work. Because this book is about generations mm-hmm. and about what lies at the bottom of the world for centuries. And so the book has certain both novelistic and autobiographical elements lying side by side. Mm-hmm. And so the book keeps recurring back on itself mm-hmm. in very exciting ways. This is Chloe Aregis reading from the shipwreck section of her novel, Sea Monsters.
The sea. Up until then, my father's only way of interesting me in the ancient world had been through shipwrecks. That was how he drew me in, made me feel occasionally connected to the ancient. Shipwrecks fall prey to all sorts of appetites, he said. The appetite of salt water, the appetite of sea creatures, the appetite of time. In the Mediterranean, there are three main saltwater macroorganisms that share a fondness for ancient timber: the shipworm, the wood piduck, and the marine gribble. All three contribute to the stratification and contamination of the wreck. These marine borers are able to endure even the harshest conditions and can adapt to nearly every depth. Water temperature and salinity are their main gauges. Marine gribbles, more sonorously known as limnoria, tunnel into the wood in pairs, with the female forging ahead. Sharp-clawed and seven-legged, they are found in most marine and brackish waters, often present in large numbers. The channels they create run parallel to the surface of the wood and tend to communicate, rendering an infested vessel even more vulnerable to corrosion. Though they roam freely, gribbles have hermit-like instincts and are loath to leave once they've ensconced in the burrows they've created. Why move home when you have a roof and an endless supply of wood, peace, and quiet? The shipworm, meanwhile, is a bivalve mollusk without shell or gender that changes sex as it grows. Also known as the termites of the sea, shipworms are less endearing in appearance than gribbles, with long, slender bodies and heads that resemble gaping mouths in service of an insatiable appetite that incessantly combs the water. Their bodies become longer as they burrow, leaving a calcareous deposit in their wake. And finally, the wood piduck. Unlike the other two, the piduck is unable to digest cellulose. It seeks out wood not for nourishment, but as protection from whatever dangers the sea may present. Its burrows are shallow and spherical. It attacks in big groups. Like the shipworm, the piduck is bisexual and similarly content to remain in its chambers once satisfactory lodgings have been found. The job of these organisms is made easier, and the yielding of submerged wood therefore swifter, thanks to the handiwork of two microorganisms, fungi and bacteria, who break down the tissue before the others come to dig their channels. Along with this array of wood-boring creatures and their lesser counterparts, wave action adds to the process of demolition. The movement of water, as well as the movement of the seabed as the sand shifts and resettles, furthers the toll on the sunken vessel. How to ignore the tragedy of the wreck, like that of a carcass in a wildlife program, no longer breathing yet under continued assault? Once the mortal blow is dealt, a host of scavengers moves in. But I also cheered for these aquatic hermits who had found a home. Listening to my father describe the scenario made me feel I had access to something vertiginally distant and mysterious. And of the various wrecks he mentioned, his favorite, and soon mine, was that of Antikythera, which had lain at the bottom of the ocean for 20 centuries. For 20 centuries, the ship and its contents had remained at the mercy of tides, currents, organisms, and upwellings. For 20 centuries, they lay silenced.
Chloe Aregis reading one of the more technical passages from her novel Sea Monsters. Now, that section doesn't sound like the rest of the book. I'm warning my listeners, you're not going to have to be reading about the termites of the sea, although I have to say, when I came on that phrase, I just laughed out loud. They are known as the termites of the ocean. And our narrator, Louisa, is finding metaphors for her own life as she looks about the world.
Yes, well, I think adolescence, it's so much about constant negotiation with the self and transformation. So it's a time when you're building your own imaginary, and so much of the poetry, music, conversations at dinner with parents feed into this inner world that you're building. And so in her case in particular, she is actively looking for metaphor and finding that so many of these different elements in her life somehow talk to each other in mysterious ways.
Her favorite teacher is her French teacher, and he gives her the opportunity to read poetry by Baudelaire. And each student has to pick a poem to analyze, and she picks
Voyage à Cythère, Voyage to Cythera,
which is about the place where the goddess of love was born. And of course, what adolescent wouldn't want to know where love was born? And her teacher has told her that she's got to look in the sea to find the birth of love. And so much of this book has to do with leaving central Mexico, where Mexico City is, and going to the coastal cities. And this is where, in many ways, she does discover love and also doesn't. She's fascinated. You know, she reads in the newspaper that there's been a troop of
Ukrainian dwarves who've defected from a Soviet circus that was touring Mexico.
And she's run away partly to find the Ukrainian dwarves. I mean,
that is based on a note we found in the paper at the time. And so it for years afterwards, it haunted me and my family, what happened to these dwarves. And my father and I actually went to the newspaper, went through the archives. There was never any follow-up. But I thought, I have to put that in the book. And because my character is fascinated by the Soviet world and circus, cosmonauts.
Oh, my. I'm talking to Chloe Aregis. She's the author of Sea Monsters, a novel, but it's like a novel built the way a sonnet is built. It's built out of images that comment on one another and build until they come to a kind of, well, shall I say, conclusive inconclusiveness. Now, what interests you about the inconclusive aspects of the book?
I felt that was very much what I wanted to create, was leaving, and I think in all three of my novels, but particularly in this one, what took the longest was to find the right form for it. But within that form, I wanted to leave a lot very open and undetermined. And I think even in terms of Lautremont, for instance, who was proto-surrealist, and because he was Uruguay and then returned to, well, came to France. But he had many hybrid creatures in his work.
I went to school in Buffalo, New York. And one student said, well, the songs of Mount Aurore. I said, what? He said, by Lautremont. I said, I've never heard of it. Oh, a surrealist classic prior to surrealism, written by a person who died by age 24. He was, yes, from Uruguay. And this, for many people, is a comment on the relationship between South American literature and surrealist French literature. Carlos Fuentes has a whole novel, Distant Relations, which involves this. Lautremont becomes a figure in Sea Monsters as well, because he is so young, and this is a book about adolescents who are seeing deeply into everything they see. And Luisa, meets someone she thinks of as a sea... What's the male?
Merman.
Merman, yes. Merman. And she drinks with him at night. They share a table, frequently not speaking.
He's very silent.
She knows very little about him, but she has fallen in love with him, leaving the boy she ran away with behind to become fascinated by her merman.
And that was something of I thought about a lot of during adolescence. There's a constant redrafting of fantasy. So one week, someone fits the fantasy, and the next week, you're projecting onto the next character. And so in this case, with the merman, she envisions him as a mysterious Eastern European, or maybe even Russian, who appeared on the beach. She has no idea where he disappears to every night.
And she finds out and is disappointed. But by this time, her father has come to look for her, and her parents have been very frightened, very worried. And in fact, as you heard in the passage, it's her father who's taught her about shipwrecks and about sea creatures and about things that last centuries beyond their overdue date.
Exactly. And that somehow I'm bringing a mythological element to one's personal history.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW, and I'm talking with Chloe Arigis about her wonderful novel, Sea Monsters. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Chloe Arigis about her novel Sea Monsters, the mesmerizing tale of a 17-year-old in search of a traveling troupe of Ukrainian dwarves and other life mysteries. She has left Mexico City and is in a coastal beach town. Say it for me again.
Zipolite.
Zipolite. And it's a novel about growing up and not growing up, and being imprisoned and being free simultaneously. I found it to be in that way, the way of its ambiguity and its oppositions, to be very poetic. Is it a poem of sorts, this novel?
I hadn't thought about it consciously when writing it, but the other day someone called it a symbolist novel, and I was thrilled, and I thought, I would never say that about myself, but I very much like the idea of it as some sort of updated symbolist poem.
Yes, and your dissertation was about the symbolists, who many people don't know. They were the strongest, perhaps, influence on T.S. Eliot. They were French poets, and you wrote your dissertation on the symbolist poets and magic, because magic had become popular at the time the symbolist poets were writing. When was that?
Well, I wrote on two magicians who both wrote memoirs. Wow. One was Robertson, who traveled around Europe with his magic lantern and conjuring spectacles of phantasmagoria. And it's thought Goya, who was Baudelaire's favorite painter, they think Goya witnessed one of these spectacles. So Robertson was on the cusp, late 18th century, early 19th. And Robert Houdin, whom Houdini named himself after, was considered the first modern magician, was mid-19th century.
Now tell me about the connection between magic and poetry.
Well, I began thinking, because I was doing my, in the faculty, it was modern languages, so I was working on 19th century French poetry, and I was very struck by how so many of the poets of the period, like Nerval, in his madness, he lived a day-to-day magic and would wander the streets of Paris encoding everything and finding signals, reading signals and faces and objects. And then Mallarmé, who also thought of poetry as almost a theatrical act and the empty page as a sort of stage, and Rimbaud with his alchemy of vowels. So, and then the magicians of the period, so they believed and were practicing a certain magic that in a way was more transcendent than the magicians of the period, who were trained engineers, and it was much more about
technique,
exactly, technique. A very different kind of illusion.
Oh, it's very interesting. Am I remembering correctly that it was Nerval who walked his lobster about on
exactly.
a leash?
Exactly.
And when
with
asked,
ribbon, yeah.
Yes, who wouldn't? And when asked why, I remember this beautiful sentence, because he is beautiful and because he knows the secrets of the deep.
That's wonderful.
Isn't that wonderful? And this book is about bringing the secrets of the deep, whether those are the secrets of the heart or the secrets of the shipwrecks lying under the ocean or the secrets of adolescence. Now, this is your third novel. And I would say I've read all three because I hadn't read them before. I liked this one so much that I had to read the others. But they seem to be a progression. You seem to be figuring out how to make a novel do the things that you found previously in poetry. In the first book, Book of Clouds, well, it sounds like a very poetic book, but it's about Berlin mm-hmm. and the wall. The second book is called it's called Asunder.
But there's a lot of meandering in it.
There is a great deal of of meandering in all of these novels. But here, in the most recent book, Sea Monsters, the meandering has taken a form. It really, the book is, you told me before we began that you'd rewritten this book a great deal. And I said that it reads like a book that has been rewritten until every element is in its place and then concealed, so that you have the pleasure of discovery and at the same time of that sense of a shipwreck that's been underwater for centuries.
Decompression is the way that history is decompressed from a shipwreck, and I wanted to somehow distill it.
Now, there are surprises here. One of the surprises is the appearance, am I right? This is the town where William Burroughs was living. Yes? Or is it in Roma?
It's in Mexico City, in Roma, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, on the street of Monterrey.
Where he...
Shot.
Yeah. He was demonstrating the William Tell exactly. trick with Apple, and he shot his wife. And this place has become a place where tourists come to see what the Beats were doing, what this significant apartment meant. So as opposed to the birth of love, which Louisa seeks out, it's the death of love that she finds in that apartment. And constant contraries, twinned, are running through this book, yes?
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, I'm so happy.
Well, I'm so happy that you found it.
Now tell me, what led you to want to write a book that operated at so many depths at the same time?
It was just instinct and impulse. I think if I'd set out with that in mind, I might have failed. I explored the themes I wanted to explore and set up some sort of metaphorical framework where they could all function separately and together.
And when you say that this is a book that you wrote and rewrote many times, was it in sections and you divided it and sort of juxtaposed images? Because it seems to be, the more I think about the book, the more exquisitely shaped it seems to me to be, just like the shape of a spiral seashell. You just think, nature did that?
Thank you. Well, in earlier drafts, it was chronological, and then it wasn't interesting. The story of building up until the fugue, and then they run off to the beach, and it just wasn't interesting, and it didn't open up a space for digressions and, well, that sort of, so different kind of meandering. But I did think, I was reading Valérie's essay on seashells, and I was thinking a lot about spirals.
Oh, that's a great essay.
It's absolutely wonderful.
Yes. If listeners are interested, this has been published in a new translation as a whole little book, Valérie on Seashells. And he, Valérie, is one of the presiding deities in this book, yes? It seems to me that other writers are the secret gods of this book, yeah?
Yes, I don't even mention him, but that essay on seashells and that slow progression of a spiral forming and there's several allusions to him in the book. I have my teacher say about events are the froth of things, but the ones to interest should be the sea. That's Valérie.
Not the froth, but the sea.
Exactly, not the froth, but the sea.
It's beautiful. I've been talking with Coe Arigis, author of a wonderful new novel, an original novel called Sea Monsters. It's published by a very good and interesting publishing house called Catapult. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
It's been a real pleasure. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, which is also available at Apple, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts. Plus, you can listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer and assistant, Sean Sullivan. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
He's a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Marlon James is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.